This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents After the Affair, Healing the Pain and Rebuilding Trust When a Partner Has Been Unfaithful, by Janice Abram Spring, Ph.D., with Michael Spring. Read by Janice Abram Spring. Can a couple survive infidelity? As a clinical psychologist who's been treating distressed couples for 21 years, my answer is yes, provided that each of you is willing to look honestly at yourself and at your partner and acquire the skills you need to see yourself through this shattering crisis. Must an affair involve intercourse? What about a kiss? Or just lunch? I don't try to answer these questions because in the end, what matters is what matters to you. You alone determine what constitutes a breach in trust. There are three other judgments I also don't make. 1. I don't make blanket judgments about whether affairs are in themselves good or bad. What may be enhancing for one of you may devastate the other and destroy the relationship. 2. I don't separate the two of you into victim and victimizer. Each of you must accept an appropriate share of responsibility for what went wrong. 3. I don't suggest that you should stay together no matter what, or leave just because you feel unhappy. Instead, I help you arrive at a decision to recommit or leave that is deliberate and well considered, not based on feelings alone. Throughout the audio, I refer to partners as hurt or unfaithful. The hurt partner is the person in the primary relationship whose assumption of monogamy has been violated. The unfaithful partner is the one who had the affair. The quotes and case studies I refer to are drawn from my private practice in Westport, Connecticut, but I've masked all identities to protect these individuals' confidences. Some of you may not want to risk starting over and exposing yourself to further hurt or disappointment. Turning your back on a damaged relationship may be the simplest or the most sensible solution, one that frees you from the tyranny of hope. But it may also be a way to escape growing up, facing some bitter truths about life, love, and yourself, and assuming the terrible burden of responsibility for making your relationship work. If you choose to recommit to each other, you may in time come to see the affair as an alarm, a wake-up call. Given how battered you both feel, you probably don't have many chances to test the strength of your relationship. I encourage you to enter the process, to challenge the hurt, and to see what you're capable of producing together. In essence, on the count of three, I invite the two of you to step into the center of the ring, remove your boxing gloves, and join hands. I'd like to begin by talking to you, the hurt partner. There's no way to prepare yourself for the crushing revelation that your partner has been unfaithful. Gone is your fundamental sense of order and justice in the universe. Gone, too, are your sense of control over your life, your self-respect, your very concept of who you are. You may feel abandoned by everyone, family, friends, even God. Battered by feeling so intense, you may start to wonder, am I going crazy? I want to assure you that you're not. That in fact what you're experiencing is a normal and appropriate response to an acutely traumatizing experience. You're reeling not only from the loss of the integrity of your relationship, but also from the loss of an illusion that you're special to your partner and that the intimacy you thought you shared would last forever. In the face of such shattering news, it would be strange if you didn't feel lost. The healing process begins when you bear witness to your feelings and make sense of your pain. It's likely at this moment that your mind and body are in shock as you undergo physiological changes in both your nervous system and cognitive functioning. Chronically anxious and agitated, you become exhausted from sleeping too little and thinking entirely too much. It's alarming, but not unusual, to find yourself suddenly disoriented. What happened to Gloria, a 30-year-old journalist, is typical. The day after my husband admitted he was having an affair, I got lost going to work, she told me. I was terrified that I was not only losing him, I was losing my mind. Another very different physiological change takes place with the release of endogenous opioids, similar to morphine, into your nervous system. This dulls your perception of pain and shields you from extreme emotional stress. In other words, your body constricts, goes into hibernation, shuts down. You lose interest in relationships and activities that only weeks before gave you pleasure and purpose. As you struggle to pull yourself together, you find yourself barely functioning. Your mind wanders. You can't concentrate. Stephanie, a 42-year-old special education teacher, explained, "It's like going through the motions of living, aware that a part of you has died. I once felt like John and I were connected by a golden thread. I'd glance across the room and feel the energy drawing us to each other. Now the best I can say is, I'm managing, we're still together, but inside, I'm dead." There are 9 different types of losses which you, the hurt partner, are likely to experience. All are variations on one very basic loss, the loss of self. Let's look at them. The first is your loss of identity. If you, my life partner, are not the person I thought you were, and our marriage is a lie, then who am I, you ask? Roberta, married 14 years, grappled with her sudden loss of identity. I used to like myself. I used to think of myself as a nice person, as a loving, lovable human being. That's gone. I can't stop thinking that the reason Don cheated on me is because I'm too sweet or too ordinary. Maybe I'm alone for a reason. Maybe no one worth knowing would want to be in a relationship with me. The loss of your basic sense of self is an injury which cuts much deeper than the infidelity itself. What could be more distressing than the experience of being stuck in skin that feels alien to you? Unable to recognize that person you always counted on to tell you who you are. The second loss is your loss of a sense of specialness. Swept away is your conviction that you and your partner were meant for each other, that together you formed a primal union that could not be shared or severed. The affair marks the passing of 2 innocent illusions, that your marriage is exceptional, and that you are unique or prized. Nancy, a mother of a 9-month-old girl, confessed, "I thought seriously about getting a 1-way ticket out of here, leaving everyone and everything behind. I felt I couldn't compete with Jim's girlfriend. She seemed so young and alive compared to me. I lost my sense of myself as a nurturing, significant, worthy human being. Thank God I came to see. This was just my depression talking and stayed put. Maybe I wasn't special to Jim anymore, but I was still my daughter's only mother. When you, like Nancy, are willfully discarded by someone who once made you feel irreplaceable, you run the risk of magnifying your defects. Keep in mind that your ability to see yourself clearly right now is likely to be at an all-time low. The third loss is your loss of self-respect for debasing and compromising yourself to win your partner back. Nothing may seem more unforgivable to you than the extremes to which you go once the affair is revealed, extremes which later fill you with shame and rage. These desperate acts make you realize that not only has your partner abandoned you, you've abandoned you. Ruth, a 47-year-old attorney, offers an example of how hurt partners sacrifice their dignity and self-respect to keep their relationships alive. I couldn't help feeling competitive, actually inferior, to Jack's super attractive lover, she told me. So I spent hours, as well as a fortune, trying on skimpy underwear in the Bloomingdale's lingerie department, when I should have been visiting my mother, who was in the hospital, recuperating from the removal of a cancerous tumor. It's so depressing. I feel sick just telling you about it. I'm humiliated by what I've done, by what I've become. If you feel you've lost yourself, be assured that you're not alone and that your response is exactly appropriate to your injury. If you can accept how deeply the infidelity has altered you, both physiologically and psychologically, perhaps you can learn not to judge yourself so harshly. Loss number four is the loss of self-respect when you hid from your suspicions or failed to acknowledge that you were wronged. Dave, married 4 years, was mystified by the magic he performed in his head to dispose of disturbing information. One day I found an unopened condom in my wife's car. It was a different brand than we normally used, so I asked her about it. She tossed off some excuse that it was a sample that came in the mail, a story not even the biggest moron would have swallowed. I look back now and wonder why I didn't confront her, why I didn't draw the line. Once the affair is out in the open, you can expect to swing from denial to the other extreme of hypervigilance. Your suspicions are likely to be so relentless that whatever your partner says or does, you can no longer distinguish truth from fiction. On some level, this transformation from blindness to watchfulness is adaptive. The mind retains the memory of the injury to protect you from future harm. Whether you're with your partner or someone new, your mistrust is unlikely to ever completely disappear. Loss number five is the loss of control over your thoughts and actions. The mind has a mind of its own, and at times like these, refuses to be controlled. Your obsessions take over, and you find yourself staring off into space as images of your spouse and the lover bombard your consciousness, interrupting your sleep or concentration. Don't be surprised if you find yourself conjuring up scenes of violent revenge. The viciousness of these images may alarm you. They're so uncharacteristic of the way you normally think, but under the circumstances, they're not abnormal. Though they lead nowhere fruitful, they're your mind's way of imposing order and justice on your world and giving yourself a sense of control. Your mistrust will also cause you to behave compulsively, reflexively, without reason or restraint. Marge told me, "I still rifle through my husband's mail. It's been 6 months since I found out what was going on with his assistant, but I can't stop myself from picking through his telephone receipts and credit card statements. I listen in on his phone conversations. I call him at the office to see if he's there, and if he's not, I use his code to listen to his voicemail. I watch, I check, I set traps, and I waste an unbelievable amount of time and money. I know I'm out of control, but I can't seem to help myself. You, like Marge, are no doubt determined never to be made a fool of again. Your constant vigilance, however, is likely to exhaust you physically and mentally, and further undermine your self-respect. It certainly won't bring back the trust or closeness you're hoping to restore. Another common form of compulsive behavior is excessive exercise and dieting, activities which you hope will give you more control over your life, make you more attractive to your partner, and restore your self-esteem. While there are some benefits to these activities, you should realize that in your hypercritical and depressed state, you're in no shape to evaluate your physical attractiveness, and you risk subjecting yourself to a regimen that's punishing, depriving, and extreme. Understand that no workout or diet will get at the root problems, your fear of abandonment, and your shattered sense of self. It's scary to feel that you've lost control over your mind and body, that your mind wields so little influence over the way you conduct your life. Rest assured, however, that though you're experiencing yourself in odd ways, your behavior is not odd. Your sixth loss is the loss of a fundamental sense of order and justice in the universe. When Sam learned that his wife Jane was sleeping with their neighbor, his whole world came unglued. I had thought of myself as a basically decent husband who earned his wife's love, he told me. I was completely committed to Jane and tried to be there for her. Now I feel misled and cheated. I see you don't win any prizes for being decent. In fact, you can get kicked in the face. I hate her for what she's done to me. I've become cynical and selfish, and I doubt I'll ever see people as good or love as good again. Depressed, confused, you may assume either that the world doesn't work according to the principles you once took for granted, a condition which leads to outer chaos, or that you don't measure up, an idea which leads to inner chaos. Not now, perhaps, but later on, you'll see that both of these perspectives are exaggerated and overgeneralized. You really don't have to crucify yourself or the world. Life is not so random, nor you so foul. The seventh loss is the loss of religious faith, which leaves you feeling punished or abandoned by your God. As Rabbi Harold Kushner points out in When Bad Things Happen to Good People, when people are struck by misfortune, the question they most frequently ask is, if God existed, if he was minimally fair, let alone loving and forgiving, how could he do this to me? Some clergymen will spoon out the old religious platitudes, telling you, for instance, that if you forgive, you shall be forgiven. Others, concerned about contributions and church attendance, won't want to take sides. Many will be sensitive and supportive, of course, but given how wretched you're feeling, it's possible that no one can console you right now. Being let down by religious leaders can turn your faith into a mockery and your God into a detached and powerless figurehead. Whether your disillusionment is with a clergyman or with God himself, you're likely to feel abandoned by one of your most familiar and profound sources of affirmation and spiritual sustenance. Try to keep in mind that such feelings are normal at this stage and do not necessarily presage a permanent loss of faith. The eighth loss is your loss of connection with others. While one part of you wants to reach out and tell the world how you've been violated, another part wants to remain silent and alone. One moment, you're craving confirmation that you're a likable human being, and clinging to anyone who will listen to your story and acknowledge that you've been harmed. The next, you're withdrawing into isolation, driven by a sense of pride, a fear of ridicule, and a perverse sense of responsibility for protecting the very person who deceived you. You worry about unburdening yourself to family and friends. Will turning them against my partner make it more difficult for us to get back together, you wonder? Is it wise to burden our kids with the ugly truth? Your sense of shame and inferiority may make you think that everyone's talking about you and avoiding you like the plague. Why else have they stopped calling to say hello or invite you out? It's important to realize that some people treat adultery as a contagious disease that might infect their own relationship if they get too close to you. Since the subject of infidelity for these people is taboo, try not to expect too much from them or take their coldness personally. It's likely that they're threatened by what they don't understand or that their own relationships are more fragile than they want to admit. Most of your friends will want to help and comfort you, but simply don't know what to say or how to begin. At the news of a partner's infidelity, even your closest friends may have no idea how to help you grieve. Unsure of what to say or do, they may avoid you or cut you off. It's important to realize that they may be looking for cues from you that you want company, that you don't want to be alone. Often their staying away is motivated by respect for what they believe is your wish for privacy. You may need to invite them back into your life. Whatever you decide to do, beware of isolating yourself and overdeveloping your solitary life. If you assume that your closest friends don't want you around or that you always must be buoyant and entertaining when you socialize, you'll make yourself even lonelier and deny yourself the consolation you so sorely need. If there's a network of people who give wholeness and meaning to your life, reach out and re-engage yourself with them, even if you're uncomfortable and self-conscious at first. The ninth and final loss is the loss of a sense of purpose, even the will to live. When you can't imagine ever loving or being loved again, when you lose your ability to value yourself or your life, when living feels more painful than not living, it's not surprising that your thoughts turn to suicide. This is the most tragic response to your partner's affair. Paula, the mother of a mentally retarded daughter, was pregnant with her second child when she learned that her husband was sleeping with her best friend. "One day I lost it," she told me. "I couldn't come up with any reason to live. My unborn child deserved more than I could give or the world could give," I thought. So I shut the garage door, sat my daughter down next to me in the car, and turned on the motor. Was I out of my mind? I think I was, with grief, with hatred. I was saved by the realization that this was a crazy thing to do, that I had an obligation to be there for my children, and that perhaps my husband had acted crazily as well. We've both been so let down as parents. Maybe we expected our relationship to compensate for what life didn't give us. We're finally beginning to acknowledge our bitterness at the cards we've been dealt and learning to pull together as friends. For you, as for Paula, few life events are more devastating than your partner's betrayal. Remember, though, that your depression is like a thick morning fog obscuring your vision, and that having suicidal thoughts is different from acting on them. What you want to kill is not yourself, but your pain. Your job right now is to do your best to tolerate your despair, even if you don't yet know how to change it. At this moment, you may find it impossible to believe what I'm telling you, but you need to trust that you can, over time, learn to value yourself again and develop authentic connections with people who matter to you. Let me add a word about sex differences, about how being a man or woman may influence the way you, the hurt partner, respond to the affair. In general, women are more likely to try to rehabilitate the relationship and keep it alive. Men are more likely to end it and find a replacement. Women tend to get depressed and strike out at themselves. Men tend to get angry and strike out violently at others, if only in their fantasies. Women are more apt to attribute the affair to their general unworthiness, men to their sexual inadequacy. Women exaggerate the significance of the affair and take longer to heal. Men compartmentalize their pain and move on. Now let's turn to the unfaithful partner and see how you are likely to respond to the affair. No matter how badly you feel, the effects of your infidelity are almost never as shattering, disorienting, or profound for you as they are for the person you deceived. Your sense of self has not been assaulted. It's very likely, in fact, that the opposite is true, that the experience of having a lover has validated you. You may feel desired by two persons, whereas your partner feels loved by none. The affair may also give you a new sense of control over your world, with more power, more choices than ever before. Unburdening yourself of your secret should take a huge weight off your mind and offer some temporary relief, but you're likely to remain as conflicted as before. While part of you may be irresistibly drawn to your lover, another part may be disgusted with yourself for cheating or making your children suffer. The bitterness you thought you felt toward your partner may soften into remorse at the pain you're inflicting. You may decide to give your relationship another chance, only to discover that your partner isn't ready to let you off so easily. As you agonize over your options and the compromises which each entails, you may find yourself trapped in a minefield of choices, paralyzed, unable to stay or leave. You need to remind yourself that these are your issues, and you will have to grapple with them alone. Your partner is in no frame of mind to appreciate your predicament. Your conflict over leaving your lover, your grief at losing a soulmate or best friend, why should your partner care? To expect sympathy or understanding will only alienate your partner further. Although your partner may insist on an unconditional commitment, you're probably not equipped to make any irreversible life decisions at this fragile time. Your immediate task is to identify your intense and contradictory feelings and recognize how appropriate and normal they are at this stage of your journey. One of the most common of these feelings is a surge of relief once the truth is out. Even if you don't know where you're headed, you're likely to feel deliciously extricated from the complications that your lies and deceits created for you. You may even feel cleansed or sanitized. Confessing the secret may make you feel whole again, but before long, your feelings are likely to become more muddled and complex. You, the unfaithful partner, are also likely to feel impatient to rebuild the relationship and move on. It's not just that you want to reconnect, but more selfishly, that you want to stop feeling guilty every time you confront your partner's pain. Your partner, however, operating under a different timetable, is likely to be outraged at your apparent efforts to minimize the damage and dispose of it. You wonder, how long do I have to put up with my partner's incessant, guilt-inducing verbal assaults that seem to resolve nothing and only pull the two of us further apart? For now, you need to hang in there with as much compassion and forbearance as you can muster, bearing witness to your partner's emotional chaos, and through caring acts, make your partner feel secure, valued, and willing to risk loving you again. A third feeling you're likely to have is chronic anxiety. To manage this, now that the affair is out in the open, you may plunge into a flurry of activity, sometimes purposeful, other times meaningless, sometimes to build a new life, other times to avoid thinking about it. Any diversion will do, watching TV, exercising, shopping, so long as it draws you away from the real task of confronting yourself and your life. As Dave told me, after I confessed to my wife and broke off with my lover, I was frantic to have a completely new life. I never gave myself a chance to think, much less feel anything. In 1 week, I quit smoking, started working out, designed a new wing off the bedroom of our house, reorganized my office, and bought a new expensive toy, a faster, sleeker boat. Change was the operative word. It took months to realize that I hadn't even begun dealing with any of the real issues. As Dave discovered, compulsive busyness is nothing but a superficial and temporary fix, a distraction from deeper, more unsettling issues within yourself and your relationship that ultimately need to be addressed if you're going to build a new life together. As the unfaithful partner, you may also feel little or no guilt for your affair. This apparent callousness is likely to have an explosive effect on your partner. It's the height of insensitivity, the final insult, a patient named Glenn told me, when his unfaithful wife admitted that she wasn't sorry for having an affair. She says she wants me back, but she doesn't have a shred of regret for cheating on me. Is she totally blind to my feelings, or is it that I matter so little to her? One reason why you, like Glenn's wife, may feel no guilt or need to apologize is that you're angry at your partner, and guilt and anger are inversely related. The greater your anger, the less your guilt. The more venom you direct at your partner, the less you direct at yourself. Your anger may be a legitimate response to the way your partner has treated you, or a defense against the guilt you feel for what you've done. What makes it hard to know the difference is that anger always feels justified. It's a basic characteristic of the emotion. A second reason why you may not feel guilty is that you're euphoric over the affair. Transported by an intense sexual or emotional connection to your lover, removed from the mundane obligations of an enduring relationship, you may not care about or even question how your behavior affects others. I feel so supremely happy, so in sync with the world. I don't want to analyze it, one patient told me. I just want it to last. Since it's natural to attribute meaning to our feelings, the unadulterated joy you feel may signal to you that what you're experiencing is true love at last and leave no room for guilt. This doesn't necessarily mean that your relationship is doomed. It may signify only that the affair has a powerful, intoxicating hold on you at this moment in time. Later on, looking back, you may realize that you were caught in a whirlwind of emotions and unable to sort through them until the dust cleared. A third reason why you may not experience guilt is that you hold certain assumptions which justify your adulterous behavior. Some of these assumptions are likely to predate your relationship and reflect long-held ideas about love and commitment. Others may be rationalizations, conjured up to protect your self-esteem, suppress your guilt, and grant you permission to stray. Here are a few examples. My affair is permissible so long as I love this person. My affair is permissible so long as I don't love this person. A one-night stand, a fling, doesn't change our relationship. My affair lets me satisfy my needs without breaking up the family, I'm doing it for the kids. People aren't meant to be monogamous. Since my partner probably knows about my affair, but isn't confronting me, it must be okay, so long as I don't flaunt it. I encourage you to look at these and other assumptions which lie behind your feelings and ask yourself, are these ideas true? Are they useful? Do they still serve me today? You may discover that some of them are undermining your ability to be intimate and faithful and decide to revise or reject them. Keep in mind that without an attitude that supports fidelity, you're more likely to stray. It would not be abnormal if after the affair, you, the unfaithful partner, grieve the loss of your lover for months or even years. Your sadness is understandable. This new companion may have seemed like a lifeline to you, drawing you into a world of sexual excitement and intimacy that you thought was out of reach. You may have felt understood and cared for in a way you no longer dreamed was possible. Or perhaps you just had more fun and felt more alive. What you should consider is that what you have come to value so deeply is not necessarily the lover, but how the lover made you feel. That what you're seeking is not a replacement for your partner, but an alteration of your basic sense of self, and that what you need can perhaps be found with your partner, if you're both willing to open yourselves to change. You both have to live with the ghost of the lover, but that doesn't mean your life together can't be rich and fulfilling. If you, the unfaithful partner, are a parent, you're likely to worry about the effect your affair is having on your children and on their feelings toward you. What could be more frightening than the prospect of losing their love and respect? There are likely to be two voices warring within you. The child, encouraging you to listen to your passions and live for the moment. And the duty-bound parent, reminding you of your greater long-term responsibility to your family. It's hard to know which voice to listen to. Perhaps all you can do right now is console yourself with the knowledge that nothing you do will make you totally happy or satisfy all your needs, that whatever decision you make will be tinged with regret. It may help to remind yourself that your kids will grow up and that their feelings toward you and your affair are likely to change over time. Your own understanding of what happened will change as well, and so will the way you explain it. Isolation is another feeling you're likely to grapple with. The cruelest rejection may come from your parents. At first, my mother called me every day to say I was making her sick, Barry told me. She backed off only after I stopped taking her calls. Lately, she tries to be supportive by asking me how I'm doing, but I can see she's looking straight through me, wondering where she went wrong and how I got so screwed up. Domestic tranquility, that's what they wish for you. The last thing they care to hear about are your marital problems or your joy in the arms of your lover. Your closest friends may also not want to hear about your conflicts, particularly those who know you and your partner as a couple and are anxious not to take sides. Some may have moral blinders on or feel too threatened by the fragility of their own relationship to support your feelings or come to your defense. Others will assault you with their theories about love and commitment when all you want is a sympathetic ear. One sensible option at this vulnerable time is to consult a therapist, someone who's likely to be neutral and therefore able to respect your feelings and help you make sense of your chaos. It's common at this early stage to see your relationship as an emotional death camp with no chance of pardon or escape. You may decide to stay for many reasons. Fear of being alone, guilt, the children, financial security, a sense of moral responsibility. But you may assume that love is gone forever and that your partner is incapable of meeting your needs. Your situation could turn out to be less bleak, but only if you don't allow your sense of hopelessness to dictate your behavior. It would be sad if, because of the way you're feeling now, you never give your partner a chance to please you. To leave or stay, to run off with your lover, or say goodbye, these critical choices are likely to leave you paralyzed with indecision, unable to move or stand still. All you know is that you can't juggle two lives anymore. It's too much to handle. Trapped in your ambivalence, you can expect to find yourself bombarded with questions for which there are no obvious answers. Do I still love my partner? Am I normal? Why is this happening? How do I get out? And from which relationship? Before you hastily draw conclusions about the future, try to leave yourself open to the many warring emotions and realize that love is not pure. It's made up of many complex, sometimes contradictory feelings. Human beings aren't constructed to feel any one way about anything, least of all love. Whatever you feel now about your love life, relieved, empowered, ambivalent, trapped, you may also feel deeply ashamed of yourself for violating religious or family values that enjoined you to honor marital vows and stay the course. Grace, married 12 years, upbraided herself for sleeping with a tennis instructor at her health club. "I can't believe how easily I turned my back on fidelity, commitment, honesty, all the values I thought I believed in. I'm finally getting the love, attention, and affirmation I so desperately need, but I've broken every rule in the book to get it and sold my soul as well." Guilt can be a healthy reminder that you've been untrue to yourself, a message to live more closely to your convictions. But when it makes you write yourself off as no good, you cheat yourself of the opportunity to change and grow. I suggest, therefore, that you direct your reproach not at yourself, the person, but at those specific qualities within you which you dislike or consider maladaptive. These include: 1. Feeling so insecure, so uncertain about yourself, that you become vulnerable to the attentions of those who build you up. 2. Keeping your unmet needs from your partner, then going elsewhere to have them met. 3. Feeling entitled to have your needs met without regard for the needs of others. 4. Craving excitement and novelty to the point of not being able to tolerate the ordinariness, the predictability of an enduring relationship. And 5. Ignoring or being unaware of your own personal conflicts, and then blaming your unhappiness on your partner. While you may want to explore these and other qualities that you consider unattractive in yourself, you do yourself a disservice if you focus on them exclusively and ignore your partner's role. You have no right to blame your partner for your affair. No one makes you cheat. But you have every right to address how your partner contributed to your dissatisfaction. Does your sex, being a man or woman, influence the way you, the unfaithful partner, respond to the affair? Current research shows that women are more apt to have affairs for love and companionship, while men are more often content with sex alone. Women are more likely to believe that their infidelity is justified if it's for love. Men are likely to believe that their infidelity is justified if it's not for love. women are also more likely to anguish over the affair than men are. Of course, no single response is the property of one sex. The gender differences discussed here are meant only to help you and your partner develop a fuller understanding of each other's behavior at this impossible time. I hope that by giving a language to your feelings, I've assured both of you that you're not crazy or unstable, that others have experienced the same pain and confusion, that you're not alone. Let's look more closely now at your ideas about love and at how they can mislead you into submitting to an unrewarding relationship or tossing out a perfectly viable one. Doing this will help you make a conscious choice and not act on feelings alone. Feelings, no matter how intense, are based on assumptions which are often highly subjective and may prove to be unrealistic, unuseful, or untrue. What feels right to you now, you may later regret as an impulsive and unprocessed response which can't be easily reversed. One kind of love, which I ask you to question, is unrequited love. This is an intense but unwarranted attachment to your partner that may make you, the hurt partner, want to stay together, no matter how dysfunctional the relationship. The blind spot behind this feeling, what you fail to see, is how unloving your partner has been toward you, how shoddily you continue to be treated, and how nothing you do will change this. Desperately, you try to get your partner to stay or come back without looking to see whether this person is good for you. Linda's husband admitted that he was having an affair with his voice instructor, but he refused to discuss it and continued to see his lover regularly, often coming home late for dinner or staying in the city overnight. Linda went from therapist to therapist, searching for strategies to lure her husband back. She didn't know it, but what she was really searching for was her lost self, the self which informed her that the intense pain and emptiness she was feeling came from loving someone who was brutally selfish and treated her with contempt. It's not within the parameters of this audio to convince you that you have a right to a life or that you're capable of making it on your own. But if you doubt yourself, you may want to get professional help to correct your self-image before you automatically slip back into an emotional wasteland. Of course, you should also question how you treat your partner. Your negative behavior may provoke the negative treatment you get in return. If you're cold or critical, you shouldn't be surprised if your partner is cold or critical too. You need to take responsibility for how your behavior has contributed to the distress in your relationship, and you have a right to expect as much from your partner. I encourage you to open your eyes to the truth of your relationship and learn to acknowledge when you've been violated. Your feelings of love should be earned. They shouldn't spring from some overactive source within you that pumps out love irrespective of how you're treated. The other kind of love I ask you to question is romantic love. This is an intense but unwarranted attachment that you, the unfaithful partner, may feel toward your lover, which makes you want to leave your partner no matter how satisfying your life together has been. My love for the lover must be real, you assume. Otherwise, I wouldn't feel such high chemistry and be willing to sacrifice so much for this person. The blind spot behind this feeling, what you fail to see, is that your so-called grand passion may have more to do with your unmet childhood needs than with who this other person really is. for the sake of an exhilarating high, which you're bound to come down from if the relationship lasts, you risk discarding a potentially salvageable, rewarding, lifelong relationship with your partner. How do you make sense of your sweeping, intoxicating feelings for your lover and your bitterness or disappointment with your spouse? Why turn away from romance when it feels so wonderful, or stay with your partner when your gut instinct is to run? Let's begin by looking at the emotional, cognitive, and chemical changes that may be taking place within you at the very thought or sight of your lover. In romantic love, your lover often becomes the single focus of your life, filling you, body and soul. And because people tend to assign meaning to the way they feel and behave, you interpret your reaction as true love. What else could explain your all-embracing obsession? The reality, though, is that a perceptual distortion has taken place. You idealize the other person, assigning to him or her more positive attributes than any one person could possibly possess. The object of your affection becomes beautiful, brilliant, stimulating, sensitive, and above all, the only one for you. At the same time, you're likely to paint your partner in equally distorted but negative terms as a foil for your lover. Boring, constricted, joyless. These are words with which you vilify your partner and justify abandoning that person and attaching yourself to someone else. This vision may ease your way out of the relationship, but it's a vision that's likely to be warped or full of holes. Your experience of intense passion has a biological base in which your body is literally swamped with amphetamine-like chemicals. The effect of these drugs doesn't last forever, however. The body gradually builds a tolerance to them and requires more of them than it can produce to achieve the same euphoric state. In the next stage of love, the brain releases a new set of chemicals called endorphins, natural painkillers that soothe you and create a sense of security and calm. These chemicals help you move from a heated infatuation to a more intimate, sustaining attachment. The problem with this biological model is that it makes the transition from romantic to mature love seem smooth and effortless, which it rarely is. Let's look now at your ideas about love. Unrealistic expectations, not your partner, may be responsible for your dissatisfaction. These expectations include: my partner should be able to anticipate my needs. The chemistry is either right or wrong. My partner should love me unconditionally. My partner should be emotionally available to me whenever I need him or her. A good marriage is free of conflict. If I'm not happy in my relationship, it's my partner's fault. When passion dies, so does the relationship. Think through these ideas about love, by yourself and with others, and ask yourself which ones you believe in and how realistic and useful they are for you. You may brush them off as the half-baked assumptions of people less sophisticated or perceptive than you. But don't be fooled. Some of them are likely to lie behind your discontent. If you accept that feelings of love are neither steady nor constant, but travel in natural cycles, you'll be more prepared to bear up under the turmoil that follows periods of contentment and see beyond it. Thus, somewhere after the romantic prelude, and as a prerequisite to entering a more solid, secure, intimate relationship, what must inevitably take place is a period of disenchantment. The cooling of romantic love inevitably carries with it a sense of loss, but it also opens the door to a more mature, committed relationship in which you accept what you love and hate in each other, tolerate feelings of ambivalence within the context of a loving relationship, and stay meaningfully attached even when you're hurt or upset. Don't give up on your partner too easily. Ask yourself, does the problem lie within our relationship or within me? Have I fallen out of love because my partner can never give me what I need, or because I'm suffering temporarily from the loss of the illusion of love, the illusion that seduced me into believing that love is constant, that I would always feel positively about my partner, that I would never have to struggle with conflicts that made me question our basic compatibility as a couple? Love is a concept as much as a feeling. How you define it and what you expect from it help determine the partners you seek and your level of satisfaction with them. Since your model of love often mirrors the way your parents or caretakers treated you or treated each other, it's revealing to look back on these relationships. Your own childhood models may help explain why you, the hurt one, continue to love an unrepentant partner, and why you, the unfaithful one, are drawn to your lover. As the hurt partner, you might choose to stay in an unfulfilling relationship because it's all you knew as a child. It's all you know today, and it feels like love to you. Since you're incapable of acknowledging the neglect or harm you're experiencing, you stay with someone who offers little or nothing in return, never questioning or evaluating your other options. As the unfaithful one, you might resent your partner for failing to give you what you never got as a child and go elsewhere to get these needs met, trusting your future to a lover you hardly know, rather than work through your disillusionment with your partner and the conflicts within yourself. You seek out or make yourself available to someone else, someone new. But what's drawing you so inexorably to your lover and creating such high chemistry between you may not be perfect love, but the way this person stirs up the unfinished business of your childhood, holding out the promise of freeing you from the abuses and deprivations of the past. An affair can reawaken you to those positive qualities in yourself which were stamped out in a depriving or abusive relationship, and give you confidence to leave a dead relationship and claim a more responsive mate. But before you turn your back on your partner, listen carefully to your fights and disappointments. They may tell the story of where you left off in your childhood development, and what you need to accomplish in your present relationship in order to heal. Ask yourself, does exiting my relationship represent a legitimate path to self-realization, or is it merely an excuse to bypass my unresolved inner conflicts? Regardless of your choice of partners, you're going to experience disillusionment, and you're going to have to work hard to keep your relationship alive and well. If you think otherwise, you're still deluding yourself. So far, I've encouraged the two of you, both the hurt and the unfaithful partner, to evaluate your assumptions about love. You may be left, however, with many reservations about recommitting. The next section helps you face them and make the pivotal choice whether to stay or leave. Let's look at 7 common concerns which men and women struggle with after an affair. Some are relevant to hurt partners, some to unfaithful partners. Most of them apply to both of you. One concern which you, the hurt partner, are likely to have is that you won't ever be able to trust your mate or feel secure in your relationship.